Parmenides. Persons of the dialogue. Cephalus, Socrates. Adamantus, Zeno. Glaucon, Parmenides. Antiphon, Aristotle's. Pythodorus. Cephalus rehearses a dialogue which is supposed to have been narrated in his presence by Antiphon, the half-brother of Adamantus and Glaucon, to certain Clazomenians.
We had come from our home at Clazomen to Athens, and met Adamantus and Glaucon in the Agora. Adamantus, taking me by the hand, said,
"Welcome, say, follow, is there anything which we can do for you in Athens?"
"Yes, that is why I am here. I wish to ask a favor of you."
"What may that be?"
"I want you to tell me the name of your half-brother, which I have forgotten. He was a mere child when I last came hither from Clazomen, but that was a long time ago. His father's name, if I remember rightly, was Pyrolamps."
"Yes, and the name of our brother, Antiphon, but why do you ask?"
"Let me introduce some countrymen of mine. They are lovers of philosophy, and have heard that Antiphon was intimate with a certain Pythodorus, a friend of Zeno, and remembers a conversation which took place between Socrates, Zeno, and Parmenides many years ago, Pythodorus having often recited it to him."
"Quite true."
"And could we hear it?"
"Nothing easier. When he was a youth he made a careful study of the piece. At present his thoughts run in another direction. Like his grandfather Antiphon, he is devoted to horses. But, if that is what you want, let us go and look for him. He dwells at Melita, which is quite near, and he has only just left us to go home."
Accordingly we went to look for him. He was at home, and in the act of giving a bridle to a smith to be fitted. When he had done with the smith, his brothers told him the purpose of our visit, and he saluted me as an acquaintance whom he remembered from my former visit, and we asked him to repeat the dialogue. At first he was not very willing, and complained of the trouble, but at length he consented. He told us that
Pythodorus described the appearance of Parmenides and Zeno. They came to Athens, at the great Panathenaeum. The former was, at the time of his visit, about 65 years old, very white with age, but well favored. Zeno was nearly 40 years of age, tall and fair to look upon. In the days of his youth he was reported to have been beloved by Parmenides. They lodged with Pythodorus in the Ceramicus, outside the wall, whither Socrates, then a very young man, came to see them, and many others with him. They wanted to hear the writings of Zeno, which had been brought to Athens for the first time on the occasion of their visit. These Zeno himself read to them in the absence of Parmenides, and had very nearly finished when Pythodorus entered, and with him Parmenides and Aristocles, who was afterwards one of the 30, and heard the little that remained of the dialogue Pythodorus had heard Zeno repeat them before. When the recitation was completed, Socrates requested that the first thesis of the first argument might be read over again, and this having been done, he said,
"What is your meaning, Zeno? Do you maintain that, if being is many, it must be both like and unlike, and that this is impossible? For neither can the like be unlike, nor the unlike like. Is that your position?"
"Just so."
"And if the unlike cannot be like, or the like unlike, then according to you, being could not be many, for this would involve an impossibility. In all that you say, have you any other purpose except to disprove the being of the many, and is not each division of your treatise intended to furnish a separate proof of this, there being in all as many proofs of the not being of the many as you have composed arguments? Is that your meaning? Or have I misunderstood you?"
"No, you have correctly understood my general purpose."
"I see, Parmenides, that Zeno would like to be not only one with you in friendship, but your second self in his writings too. He puts what you say in another way, and would fain make believe that he is telling us something which is new for you. In your poems, say the all is one, and of this you adduce excellent proofs, and he on the other hand says there is no many, and on behalf of this he offers overwhelming evidence. You affirm unity, he denies plurality, and so you deceive the world into believing that you are saying different things, when really you are saying much the same. This is a strain of art beyond the reach of most of us."
"Yes, Socrates, but although you are as keen as a Spartan hound in pursuing the track, you do not fully apprehend the true motive of the composition, which is not really such an artificial work as you imagine, for what you speak of was an accident. There was no pretense of a great purpose, nor any serious intention of deceiving the world. The truth is, that these writings of mine were meant to protect the arguments of Parmenides against those who make fun of him and seek to show the many ridiculous and contradictory results which they suppose to follow from the affirmation of the one. My answer is addressed to the partisans of the many, whose attack I return with interest by retorting upon them that their hypothesis of the being of many, if carried out, appears to be still more ridiculous than the hypothesis of the being of one. Zeal for my master led me to write the book in the days of my youth, but someone stole the copy, and therefore I had no choice whether it should be published or not. The motive, however, of writing, was not the ambition of an elder man, but the pugnacity of a young one. This you do not seem to see, Socrates, though in other respects, as I was saying, your notion is a very just one.
I understand, and quite accept your account, but tell me, Zeno, do you not further think that there is an idea of likeness in itself, and another idea of unlikeness, which is the opposite of likeness, and that in these two, you and I and all other things to which we apply the term many, participate, things which participate in likeness, become in that degree and man alike, and so far as they participate in unlikeness become in that degree unlike, or both like and unlike in the degree in which they participate in both, and may not all things partake of both opposites, and be both like and unlike, by reason of this participation? Where is the wonder? Now if a person could prove the absolute like to become unlike, or the absolute unlike to become like, that, in my opinion, would indeed be a wonder. But there is nothing extraordinary, Zeno, in showing that the things I which only partake of likeness and unlikeness experience both, nor, again, if a person were to show that all is one I, by partaking of one, and at the same time many by partaking of many, would that be very astonishing? But if he were to show me that the absolute one was many, or the absolute many one, I should be truly amazed. And so of all the rest, I should be surprised to hear that the natures or ideas themselves had these opposite qualities. But not if a person wanted to prove of me that I was many and also one. When he wanted to show that I was many, he would say that I have a right and a left side, and a front and a back, and an upper and a lower half, for I cannot deny that I partake of multitude. When, on the other hand, he wants to prove that I am one, he will say that we who are here assembled are seven, and that I am one, and partake of the one. In both instances he proves his case. So again, if a person shows that such things as wood, stones, and the like, being many, are also one, we admit that he shows the coexistence of the one and many, but he does not show that the many are one or the one many. He is uttering not a paradox but a truism. If, however, as I just now suggested, someone were to abstract simple notions of like, unlike, one, many, rest, motion, and similar ideas, and then to show that these admit of admixture and separation in themselves, I should be very much astonished. This part of the argument appears to be treated by you, Zeno, in a very spirited manner. But, as I was saying, I should be far more amazed if anyone found in the ideas themselves which are apprehended by reason the same puzzle and entanglement which you have shown to exist in visible objects.
While Socrates was speaking, Pythagoras thought that Parmenides and Zeno were not altogether pleased at the successive steps of the argument, but still they gave the closest attention, and often looked at one another, and smiled as if in admiration of him. When he had finished, Parmenides expressed their feelings in the following words.
Socrates, I admire the bent of your mind towards philosophy. Tell me now, was this your own distinction between ideas in themselves and the things which partake of them? And do you think that there is an idea of likeness apart from the likeness which we possess, and of the one and many, and of the other things which Zeno mentioned?
I think that there are such ideas.
And would you also make absolute ideas of the just and the beautiful and the good, and of all that class?
Yes, I should.
And would you make an idea of man apart from us and from all other human creatures, or of fire and water?
I am often undecided, Parmenides, as to whether I ought to include them or not.
And would you feel equally undecided, Socrates, about things of which the mention may provoke a smile? I mean such things as hair, mud, dirt, or anything else which is vile and paltry. Would you suppose that each of these has an idea distinct from the actual objects with which we come into contact, or not?
Certainly not. Visible things like these are such as they appear to us, and I am afraid that there would be an absurdity in assuming any idea of them, although I sometimes get disturbed and begin to think that there is nothing without an idea. But then again, When I have taken up this position, I run away, because I am afraid that I may fall into a bottomless pit of nonsense, and perish. And so I return to the ideas, of which I was just now speaking, and occupy myself with them.
Yes, Socrates, that is, because you are still young, the time will come, if I am not mistaken, when philosophy will have a firmer grasp of you, and then you will not despise even the meanest things. At your age, you are too much disposed to regard the opinions of men, but I should like to know whether you mean that there are certain ideas of which all other things partake, and from which they derive their names, that similars, for example, become similar, because they partake of similarity. And great things become great, because they partake of greatness, and that just and beautiful things become just and beautiful, because they partake of justice and beauty.
Yes, certainly, that is my meaning.
Then each individual partakes either of the whole of the idea, or else of a part of the idea? Can there be any other mode of participation?
There cannot be.
Then do you think that the whole idea is one, and yet, being one, is in each one of the many?
Why not, Parmenides?
Because one and the same thing will exist as a whole at the same time in many separate individuals, and will therefore be in a state of separation from itself.
Nay, but the idea may be like the day, which is one and the same in many places at once, and yet continuous with itself. In this way each idea may be one and the same in all at the same time.
I like your way, Socrates, of making one in many places at once. You mean to say that if I were to spread out a sail and cover a number of men, there would be one whole including many. Is not that your meaning?
I think so.
And would you say that the whole sail includes each man, or part of it only, and different parts different men?
The latter.
Then, Socrates, the ideas themselves will be divisible, and things which participate in them will have a part of them only, and not the whole idea existing in each of them.
That seems to follow.
Then would you like to say, Socrates, that the one idea is really divisible, and yet remains one?
Certainly not.
Suppose that you divide absolute greatness, and that of the many great things. Each one is great in virtue of a portion of greatness less than absolute greatness. Is that conceivable?
No.
Or will each equal thing, if possessing some small portion of equality less than absolute equality, be equal to some other thing by virtue of that portion only?
Impossible.
Or suppose one of us to have a portion of smallness. This is but a part of the small, and therefore the absolutely small is greater. If the absolutely small be greater, that to which the part of the small is added will be smaller, and not greater than before.
How absurd!
Then in what way, Socrates, will all things participate in the ideas, if they are unable to participate in them, either as parts or wholes?
Indeed, you have asked a question which is not easily answered.
Well, and what do you say of another question?
What question?
I imagine that the way in which you are led to assume one idea of each kind is as follows. You see a number of great objects, and when you look at them there seems to you to be one and the same idea, or nature, in them all. Hence you conceive of greatness as one.
Very true.
And if you go on and allow your mind in like manner to embrace in one view the idea of greatness, and of great things which are not the idea, and to compare them, will not another greatness arise, which will appear to be the source of all these?
It would seem so.
Then another idea of greatness now comes into view over and above absolute greatness, and the individuals which partake of it, and then another, over and above all these, by virtue of which they will all be great, and so each idea instead of being one will be infinitely multiplied.
But may not the ideas be thoughts only, and have no proper existence except in our minds, Parmenides? For in that case each idea may still be one, and not experience this infinite multiplication.
And can there be individual thoughts which are thoughts of nothing?
Impossible.
The thought must be of something.
Yes.
Of something which is, or which is not.
Of something which is.
Must it not be of a single something which the thought recognizes as attaching to all, being a single form or nature?
Yes.
And will not the something which is apprehended as one, and the same in all, be an idea?
From that, again, there is no escape.
Then, if you say that everything else participates in the ideas, must you not say either that everything is made up of thoughts, and that all things think, or that they are thoughts, but have no thought?
The latter view, Parmenides, is no more rational than the previous one. In my opinion, the ideas are, as it were, patterns fixed in nature, and other things are like them, and resemblances of them. What is meant by the participation of other things in the ideas is really assimilation to them.
But if the individual is like the idea, must not the idea also be like the individual, in so far as the individual is a resemblance of the idea, that which is like cannot be conceived of as other than the like of like.
Impossible.
And when two things are alike, must they not partake of the same idea?
They must.
And will not that of which the two partake, and which makes them alike, be the idea itself?
Certainly.
Then the idea cannot be like the individual, or the individual like the idea, for if they are alike, some further idea of likeness will always be coming to light, and if that be like anything else, another, and new ideas will be always arising, if the idea resembles that which partakes of it.
Quite true.
The theory, then, that other things participate in the ideas by resemblance, has to be given up, and some other mode of participation devised.
It would seem so.
Do you see then, Socrates, how great is the difficulty of affirming the ideas to be absolute?
Yes, indeed.
And further, let me say that as yet you only understand a small part of the difficulty which is involved if you make of each thing a single idea, parting it off from other things.
What difficulty?
There are many, but the greatest of all is this. If an opponent argues that these ideas, being such as we say they ought to be, must remain unknown, no one can prove to him that he is wrong, unless he, who denies their existence, be a man of great ability and knowledge, and is willing to follow a long and laborious demonstration. He will remain unconvinced, and still insist that they cannot be known.
What do you mean, Parmenides?
In the first place, I think, Socrates, that you, or anyone, who maintains the existence of absolute essences, will admit that they cannot exist in us.
No, for then they would be no longer absolute.
True, and therefore when ideas are what they are in relation to one another, their essence is determined by a relation among themselves, and has nothing to do with the resemblances, or whatever they are to be termed, which are in our sphere, and from which we receive this, or that name, when we partake of them, and the things which are within our sphere, and have the same names with them, are likewise only relative to one another, and not to the ideas which have the same names with them, but belong to themselves, and not to them.